Well, I think I'll start. I don't think anyone, I think it's time to, well, can we be free without God? I mean, you know, the simple way of doing this workshop is to say, can we be free without God? The answer is no, and we'll go off and have a cup of tea. But I'm going to give you some, you know, you're going to get something for your money, as it were. And I thought that before I sort of read you, I give you my paper. I mean, you've probably got a workshop sort of outline paper about this workshop, and I'm giving you something based on that. I just would like to say something by way of personal introduction as to how I got interested in this subject. I have spent 30 years or more in politics and journalism, and I used to be an atheist and very much a libertarian and very hostile to Christianity. I had great sympathy with the famous words of the great French 18th century philosopher who started the encyclopedia, Diderot, who wrote famously that he looked forward to the day when the last king was strangled with the guts of the last priest. And I'm afraid that used to be my attitude, about half a lifetime ago. When I certainly wasn't a Christian when I was at Oxford. I was very shocked by Christianity altogether. But I became a Christian through reading C.S. Lewis. And I have always been interested in the subject of liberty, something about which I feel passionately. And I've always been interested in the subject of theophobia. Why do people not just disbelieve in God, but actually dislike the biblical concept of God? And that's why I'm giving you this paper. Now, since the days of Lucretius, the Roman philosopher Lucretius, the very idea of God has aroused hostility in the hearts of many who deny or question his existence. Whilst great composers like Bach and Handel have celebrated God as creator and savior in wonderful music, countless atheists have affirmed their conviction that religious belief is rooted in fear, insecurity, and the worship of power. If God existed, it would be necessary to destroy him, declared the 19th century Russian anarchist Bakunin in his famous pamphlet, God and the State. And today, that view is echoed in the writings of best-selling fantasy novelists like Philip Pullman. I don't know how many of you have read his Dark Materials trilogy, Northern Lights, The Subtle Knife and The Amber Spyglass. It's a sort of counter to C.S. Lewis and the Narnia stories. So this theophobic attitude, this hostility to God, is echoed today in the works of best-selling novelists like Philip Pullman, and also in the best-selling fiction of the late American philosopher Ayn Rand, who was a libertarian, anti-socialist, free market philosopher, extremely hostile to Christianity and belief in God. And theophobic atheism, hostility to the idea of God, is also very prominent in the writings and comments of Darwinian scientists like Richard Dawkins, who's at Oxford, author of The Blind Watchmakers, all of you, or most of you, will know, and who has on various occasions, including in his book, The Blind Watchmaker, declared that when he discovered Darwinism, he became an intellectually fulfilled atheist. In other words, Dawkins was an atheist before he came to believe in evolution and embraced evolutionary theory as a way of pushing God out of the picture in trying to explain nature, the natural world. But perhaps the clearest expression of theophobic atheism has come from the pen of Britain's best-known 20th century philosopher, Bertrand Russell. And this is what Bertrand Russell said in a lecture delivered to the National Secular Society in 1927. "We want to stand upon our own feet and look fair and square at the world, its good facts, its bad facts, and its ugliness. See the world as it is, and be not afraid of it. Conquer the world by intelligence, and not merely by being slavishly subdued by the terror that comes from it. The whole conception of God, argued Russell, is a conception derived from the ancient Oriental despotisms. It is a conception quite unworthy of free men. When you hear people in church debasing themselves and saying that they are miserable sinners and all the rest of it, it seems contemptible and not worthy of self-respecting human beings. Very powerful denunciation, attack on the very idea of God. And it was one which I read his book, Why I'm Not a Christian, years ago when I was at school. I found it very convincing. Well, although these words were spoken over 76 years ago, they remain an accurate reflection of contemporary theophobia. It really is true that for many people, belief in God is associated with irrationality, life-hating asceticism, and intolerant fanaticism. To be a Christian, they think, involves a soul-destroying surrender of one's whole being to a cosmic tyrant whose chief claim on our obedience is that he is all-powerful and will destroy us if we reject him. Not only is this idea repugnant, it is the evil root of all religious persecution because it denies the legitimacy of freedom of conscience. In addition, many atheists believe religious faith is inimical, hostile to scientific progress because it demands unquestioning obedience to the authority of the church and uncritical adherence to religious dogmas. Many atheists don't like the Christian idea of God, the biblical idea of God, also because it interferes, as I mentioned, with their autonomy, their desire to be independent. And a very good example of this was the English writer Aldous Huxley. I don't know how many of you have read Brave New World, but anyway, Aldous Huxley wrote this in the 1930s. I had motives for not wanting the world to have meaning, consequently assumed it had none. For myself, as no doubt for most of my contemporaries, as he's obviously referring to his intellectual contemporaries, for myself, as no doubt for most of my contemporaries, the philosophy of meaninglessness was essentially an instrument of liberation. The liberation we desired was simultaneously liberation from a certain political and economic system and liberation from a certain system of morality. We objected to the morality because it interfered with our sexual freedom. That's a very powerful reason why many people dislike, let alone disbelieve, in the biblical concept of God. Now, again, some people may be tempted to wonder how extensive is this sort of theophobic atheism and hostility to God in our day. Well, I'm not going to give you all the statistics about the growth of atheism and agnosticism because, you know, so many other people at this conference and at the conference last year, for those of you who were here, have given you evidence about the growth of atheism and agnosticism in the Western culture. At the moment, something like a third of the population of Britain, at least, claim not to believe in God, and another third who do believe in God say they don't believe in a personal God. But if you look at the writings of Philip Pullman, to refer to him again, it's very interesting analyzing his Dark Materials trilogy. Although a work of fiction, its author does much more than simply tell a good and sometimes moving story about two children. He skillfully enlists the reader in his crusade against traditional religion by the simple device of caricaturing its doctrines and painting its fictional protagonists in the blackest possible colors. Their principal opponents, by contrast, the opponents of these children, are portrayed as an eclectic but attractive band of freedom fighters caught up in the cosmic struggle against spiritual oppression and cruelty. And in the paper you've got for this workshop, I give examples, quotes from Pullman, making that point. And it's interesting that by Pullman ensuring that the good rebels in his story include beautiful witches and angels, he's able to satisfy the popular craving for the supernatural while simultaneously exploiting the resentment many people feel against God because of the existence of evil and suffering. And I think that he should have achieved such commercial and critical success in attaining these goals shows the cultural resonance of contemporary theophobic atheism. Now, oh, by way of further evidence about the growth of theophobia, let me quote to you the words of a young British journalist and philosopher called Joan Smith, who wrote an article in the Guardian newspaper on the 30th of October 2000, revealingly entitled, "So the British Have Become Atheists, Thank God for That." In it, she openly gloated, "Terrific news from the Archbishop of Canterbury. We have become a society of atheists. In a startlingly pessimistic analysis of the role of the church in contemporary Britain, Dr. George Carey admits that a tacit atheism prevails and that a majority of the population no longer accepts the central tenets of Christianity." And then in the same article, Joan Smith expresses an equally revealing contempt for Christian ethics. Quote, "We have mostly outgrown such infantile attitudes in this country." Now, as a former atheist, I have a lot of sympathy with individuals who dislike the concept of God and disbelieve in his existence. All too often, history records, the worship of God has been associated with hatred, intolerance, and the abuse of power. And you can think of many examples of this: the horrors of the Spanish Inquisition, the witch hunting crazes of the 16th and 17th centuries, the wars of religion, anti-Semitic pogroms, are all grim examples of the crimes committed in God's name by those claiming to be his followers. To quote C.S. Lewis, who of course, as you all know, was himself an atheist before his conversion to Christianity, writing in his book The Four Loves, which incidentally is a magnificent analysis of the human heart, which you all ought to read if you haven't. But in this book, C.S. Lewis writes the following words: "If ever the book which I am not going to write is written, it must be the full confession by Christendom of Christendom's specific contribution to the sum of human cruelty and treachery. Large areas of the world will not hear us till we have publicly disowned much of our past. Why should they? We have shouted the name of Christ and enacted the service of Moloch." Moloch, to remind you, being the Canaanite deity to whom children were sacrificed. Now, appreciating the motives behind honest atheism should not, however, be confused with acceptance of its theophobic claims. And as I will argue in this paper, it is atheism rather than belief in God which is irrational and inimical and hostile to liberty. And I will argue that atheism is philosophically untenable, theologically perverse, and above all, fueled by a one-sided and distorted interpretation of history. To open the case for the prosecution, why is atheism irrational? In the first place, because it cannot provide a convincing explanation for the existence and complexity of life in all its myriad forms. To accept atheism, you have to believe that our extraordinary universe, with its amazingly intricate structures, processes, and organisms, is merely the accidental product of random physical and chemical events. But is this remotely credible? Is it really likely, for example, that the human body's immune system or the migratory and nest-building instincts of birds are just biological accidents? And what about the navigational systems of bats and whales, or the structure and operation of the genetic code? Are these also the unintended result of an accidental universe? If, as all would acknowledge, the most sophisticated modern computers have only come into being as a consequence of the deliberate application of human intelligence over several decades, is it credible that the infinitely more complicated human brains that created them emerged by a fluke within an idiotic cosmos? And anyway, and this is a very important question, why is our universe a cosmos and not a chaos? How do atheists explain the fact that the universe appears to be governed by a few simple laws of physics, and that its order and structure can be expressed in terms of mathematics? Does this not point to the existence of a supreme mind behind the architecture of our world? Why? if there is no divine intelligence behind the universe, have most of the great thinkers of Western civilization thought the opposite, from Plato and Aristotle to Francis Bacon and Newton. Even famous skeptics like David Hume and John Stuart Mill acknowledged the apparent strength of the argument from design, a teleological proof of the existence of God. Now, atheists commonly rely, in my experience, on two arguments to justify their rejection of the powerful evidence for the existence of an intelligent creator. The first and oldest is a problem of evil. How can a world, they argue, marred by pain, suffering, and death, be the creation of an infinitely good, loving, all-knowing, and all-powerful God? Now, this used to be a problem for me. And I used to think that this objection was a decisive objection to the argument for the existence of God from intelligent design. But this is actually illogical. The problem of evil is simply another, albeit terrible, piece within the puzzle of existence, which needs to be fitted in to its proper place within the overall picture of reality. It does not, I would suggest, it does not cancel out the evidence for intelligent design. To believe that the existence of suffering and evil does cancel out the evidence for intelligent design is rather like saying that because hatred exists within some families, there is no such thing as human love. Or that because there are badly constructed buildings in one town, this suggests the non-existence of intelligent architects elsewhere. And in any case, I would argue, atheists cannot use the problem of evil as a credible argument against the existence and goodness of God, because to do so depends on a very important assumption, on the assumption that the moral standard by which they judge the world around them to be evil is an objective one. And that assumption is hard to reconcile with atheism. And the reason it's hard to reconcile is obvious. And C.S. Lewis wrote a lot about this, of course. If we and all our thought processes are only the accidental and unintended byproduct of an ultimately random and purposeless universe, how can we attach any significance to our beliefs and values? If, on the other hand, our moral convictions are eternally true insights into reality, then does this not suggest that there is, after all, an eternal goodness and intelligence behind all things? As Lewis argued, you only know a line is crooked because you already have a concept of a straight line. You only recognize injustice because you have a prior standard of justice. But how can our prior standard of justice and meaning emerge if we're simply biochemical robots, machines, the accidental product of a purposeless universe? The difficulties atheists face in trying to explain moral awareness is but a reflection, is only a part of their inability to provide a convincing explanation of human consciousness in general. And this is a theme to which I will return later. But at this stage of the debate, we can consider their other principal argument against the existence of an intelligent creator, namely the Darwinian theory that the appearance of design in nature can be explained in terms of evolution. Well, I'm not going to go into this in great detail because you've attended networks and workshops on the issue of Darwinism. You not only have the problem of irreducible complexity that so many cells and structures in the human body consist of parts which have to work together in order to function, and how therefore could complicated cells, particularly the genetic code, how could that have evolved when everything has to be present in order to have function? But even if one didn't have that problem with evolution, with the Darwinian evolutionary picture, it lacks all credibility as a theory on philosophical grounds, because the accidental emergence of complex organs and life forms does not actually become more probable by dividing it up into many little steps over a long period of time. And the reason is obvious. According to atheists, there is no, the evolutionary process is blind. There is no target at which evolution is consciously aiming. It has no conscious purpose. And that means there is no reason to expect that all the little steps that might be necessary to occur at a certain stage and in a certain order to produce, say, the eye or the brain or any other complicated structure, there's no reason why all these collection of little steps should occur at the right time and in the right order. In fact, the chances of all the little steps taking place at the right time and in the right order for the evolution and development of the eye is overwhelmingly improbable. Why shouldn't the eyelid appear as a result of some mutation before the muscles that can move it? And if that happened, of course, that would result in blindness, and that would end the evolutionary development of the eye. So Darwinian evolution does not explain the complicated structures and processes we see all around us in nature and in our own bodies, even if you ignore the problem of irreducible complexity. But atheists face an even greater problem nearer home. They cannot provide an adequate explanation for human consciousness. And by that I mean they cannot explain our ability as human beings to think, choose, and discover moral values. We are accustomed in ordinary conversation to dismiss any argument if it can be shown to rely wholly on prejudice or on some other irrational factor or premise. For example, if you know that somebody is only arguing in favor of capitalism because they are themselves rich and are trying to defend their material interests, you're not going to take their argument seriously. If you know that somebody is arguing against the admission of women to universities because they think women should be in the kitchen, you're not going to take their argument seriously because it doesn't have a rational basis. So in ordinary conversation, we are accustomed to dismissing any argument if it can shown to have purely non-rational causes. But the problem with atheism is that if atheism is true, then it means that our minds and all our thought processes are simply the accidental byproduct of a long chain of non-rational physical causes. So how then can we attach any significance to our reasoning processes? And the same applies to free will. If atheism is true, and we're only the accidental and inevitable byproduct of a long chain of non-rational, purposeless physical and chemical events, then it just means that we're robots. So how can we have free will? Now, of course, we know that we can reason, and we know that we can have free will, because to deny that we can reason and to deny that we have free will is actually involves a contradiction. You cannot reason that you cannot reason. You cannot say we know that we cannot know anything. It's a contradiction. And the very fact that we engage in philosophical argument about anything obviously presupposes that reasoning, argument, logical thought is possible and real and enables us to reach truth. Similarly, we cannot argue that we are not free, that we have no free will, because philosophical determinists, for example, who argue that we have no free will, are contradicting themselves, because if it's true that we have no free will and all our thoughts are determined by our physical and biochemical constitution, then so are the thoughts of determinists determined. They are bound to believe that we don't have free will, because that's just the way they're programmed biologically. So the denial of free will is just as self-contradictory and absurd as the denial of reasoning. But the problem, so we can reason and we can have free will. We are able to choose. And we know that we have the ability to choose because we experience that all the time. We choose our life partner when we get married. We choose what occupation we're going to follow. We choose between different items of food on a restaurant menu. So we know that we have freedom of choice and freedom of will. But again, the problem with atheism is that atheists cannot explain how we have, on their premises, how we can reason and have free will. So that's a terrible problem, philosophical problem facing atheists. And interestingly enough, one famous Marxist scientist of the 1940s, Professor Haldane realized this. And this is what he, you haven't got this in your paper, but it's in mine. This is what he wrote. If my mental processes are determined wholly by the motions of atoms in my brain, I have no reason to suppose that my beliefs are true.
On that point,
yeah.
I believe that was to sort of integrate C.S. Lewis, Elizabeth Anderson.
Yes, yes.
Because that's the sort of argument he uses in his book, Miracles, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know the details of the debate, but people say that...
But she refuted him.
The opposite and refuted
him. No, I'll tell you what happened. What Elizabeth Anscombe argued was that whatever the psychological reasons or the physical processes going on in the brain, which result in somebody believing, say, that 2 and 2 equals 4, you can still examine an argument according to the rules of logic and determine whether or not that argument is correct. But the problem with her argument is that our very belief in the existence of rules of logic and our very belief that when we're using rules of logic in arguments, we are saying something meaningful and reaching truth, if atheism is true, is itself the product of a long chain of non-rational causes. So actually, she doesn't deal with the problem. She was basically thinking she could say, okay, so this person thinks that, so you can argue that this case for capitalism is weak because the person putting forward this argument for capitalism is only defending his wealth. You know, and his freedom to oppress his factory workers or whatever. But we can nevertheless examine the argument for capitalism, you know, that markets work better than state economies and planning and so on, and discuss all this in a rational way so you don't discredit reasoning simply by showing that there may be irrational psychological reasons why people believe one thing rather than another. But she didn't really answer Lewis's argument because her very use of the rules of logic and her belief in the rules of logic, if atheism is true, is itself a product of a long chain of non-rational causes. I mean, in other words, all our thought processes, all our choices, if atheism is true, is simply the accidental product of a long chain of non-rational physical and biochemical causes. And therefore, we have no reason for believing that they have any significance. What actually happened, I mean, it was that Lewis, in the first edition of his book, Miracles, didn't put his argument quite rigorously enough. He used the word valid, you know, no argument could be shown to be valid if it could be shown to be purely the result of irrational causes, when what he really ought to have, the word he ought to have used was verific, truthful. And in fact, he recast his argument he made it tighter in subsequent editions of the book Miracles. And Elizabeth Anscombe admitted that actually in the new version of his argument, it had much more force. And she was interviewed some years ago, and she said that looking back on that debate, she felt she had been right in criticizing the way he'd formulated his argument, but she had been wrong because she hadn't recognized the difficulty that he was drawing attention to. And in fact, there was a replay of the debate between Elizabeth Anscombe and Lewis by a philosopher called J.R. Lucas, an Oxford philosopher who's now retired. He used to be at Merton. And he challenged Elizabeth Anscombe to have a rerun of this debate. And the people who were present at that debate say that he won the argument. So, you know, I mean, philosophers... She is a Catholic. Yes, yes, she did not believe in God. She just simply... She didn't like that argument. Okay, so... Yeah, yeah.
A very good book on this whole issue recently, which is on the bookstore, it's still there, is by Chapman, Victor Rappert, Christian Hospital, Victor Rappert, C.S. Lewis's Generous Idea, which I will pay, which goes through this whole thing. And actually, within the philosophy world, various different versions of this, as that was my book, the reason, recently being defended by people like Rappert and Ian Pascoe, and it's been a kind of revival of this kind of critique of that book.
What was
his
name in the book?
C.S. Lewis is a Dangerous Idea, right. As a mixtape on Daniel Dennett's Star Wars Dangerous Idea.
Okay, well, to just resume, so atheists cannot explain our ability to reason, and they cannot explain free will. But not only can they not explain reason and free will, they cannot actually explain the fact that we have a moral law written on our hearts. Now, there are basically, of course, you heard all this yesterday, Peter, so you must just be paid, you can go to sleep at this point, but for the benefit of the others, and Carol can go to sleep because she heard this as well. But basically, the atheists will argue that you can explain morality, our moral sense of right and wrong, without introducing God. And they commonly put forward three different explanations. One is the argument from instinct. Our sense of right and wrong can be explained without reference to God because it's simply a matter of instinct. We have an instinct to help people, for example. It's just an instinct. But the problem with that argument is that our instincts are often in conflict with each other. And what our moral sense enables us to do is to choose between our conflicting instincts. The example C.S. Lewis uses in Mere Christianity is that, you know, you're walking by a frozen lake in winter, say, and you see a child fall in, go through the ice. You have an instinct to jump into the lake and rescue the child. You also have an instinct not to jump into the lake because you may drown. You have an instinct of survival which tells you don't jump into the lake to rescue the child. But in addition to these two instincts, you have something else inside you telling you, no, you ought to repress your desire to save your own skin and you ought to try and save the child by jumping into the lake. Why? Because human life is precious and valuable, and we have a duty to save life when we can. So the argument from instinct doesn't really work as an explanation of our moral sense, our sense of right and wrong. So atheists commonly come up with another argument. Well, they say the reason we have this sense of right and wrong written on our hearts is because of it has survival value. The human race has developed moral codes and the sense of right and wrong because it helps us to survive. But that's actually a very weak argument because if you look at human history, most of history is largely a story of war, oppression, killing, hatred. You know, for most people, life has been very, very grim historically. And if you look at the world today, if you look at the 20th century, you know, we've only just come out of a century which has seen two massive world wars, great totalitarian political systems like communism and fascism. And today, about half the countries that are members of the United Nations are ruled by dictatorships. If you look at statistics on crime in Britain, for example, at least 50% of all crimes are never even detected. So if it really is the case that being a good person, showing kindness, being honest, being truthful, having integrity, being sensitive to the interests of other people, if that really is the way to survive and prosper in human society, why do we have so many dictators and why do we have so many criminals? Can anyone seriously argue that, you know, that the best people morally are necessarily going to be the people who progress the most in academia or in the business world or in politics? So the argument that our moral sense is simply a tool which helps our survival is really very weak. Well, then we come to the other atheist attempt to explain our moral sense without introducing God, and that's the strongest argument they have. Well, they argue the reason we have a moral code, a sense of right and wrong, is because what is right is what is good for society. It helps us to live together in harmony. So that gives you an objective basis for morality. What is good for society is what is good. The problem with that argument is that it's a circular argument, because you can always ask the question, why should you care about the good of society? I mean, if you are clever enough or powerful enough or ruthless enough to be able to go through life trampling on the rights and interests of other people, or organizing yourself into a gang, a criminal gang, robbing banks, or else organize yourself into a political gang and take over a country like Hitler and the Nazis or Lenin and the communists. You know, what argument does the atheist have to say? What can you say to people who say, well, you know, it's in my interests to trample all over you. It's in my interests to be a dictator. It's in my interests to be a criminal. I can get away with it. And in the end, you have to say, well, you ought to value human life. Life is precious. You ought to value the rights and liberties of other people. But why? So what this basically leads to is a stark choice, metaphysical choice. Either you can adopt the nihilist position and say, there are no such things as moral values. Our sense of right and wrong is purely subjective, it's purely illusory, it's like our taste for food and clothing. And frankly, faced with a nihilist, there really isn't much you can do other than shoot them. Alternatively, you have to argue, you have to recognize that our sense of right and wrong, our recognition of the fact, for example, or the truth, that you shouldn't torture children, that it's wrong for the Ku Klux Klan to burn down black churches, is simply a self-evident truth. In other words, there are such things as moral facts, moral truths that are simply self-evident, like the truths of logic. They're axioms. And not to recognize these self-evident moral truths is to be the moral equivalent of colorblind. And that's the only... And actually, that's a very useful argument in apologetics, because, you know, although people say, you know, we live in a postmodern age and people are moral relativists, you know, they're not really moral relativists. You can call a bluff on them. If anybody says to you, oh, well, you know, morality is just a matter of choice, you can challenge them. So you think it's okay for the Ku Klux Klan to burn down black churches then, if they feel like doing. It's all right for paedophiles to sexually abuse children because they like it. It's okay, it was all right for Hitler to exterminate 6 million Jews because he liked that. You know, you can challenge, you can call the bluff. So just as we know that we can reason, just as we know that we have free will, we also know that our moral sense, our sense of right and wrong, our passionate concern for justice and right is objective, is true. So the great metaphysical question then is, how do we explain the fact that we have free will, that we can reason, and that we have a sense of right and wrong written on our hearts? And the only answer to that is that we can think and reason because our minds are illuminated by an intelligence, a self-existent eternal intelligence or supreme mind outside ourselves and beyond the physical universe who created us. We are free because the Creator gave us free will. We have a moral sense because our minds are illuminated by an eternal self-existent goodness that is outside ourselves and the physical universe. And that was Plato's great argument for the existence of God, that, you know, this objective goodness is obviously independent of us, because whether we live or die, whether we recognize its truthfulness or not, it is true. But since goodness is recognized by intelligence, it obviously is related to mind. Therefore, the eternal self-existent goodness outside ourselves and the physical universe is a supreme mind, is the manifestation of a supreme mind. So that establishes the existence of God. So theophobic atheism is bankrupt. It's philosophically bankrupt. It cannot even explain our ability to think or reason, and it cannot explain free will. We have to recognize the existence of God to recognize the reality of our inner freedom. And ironically enough, theophobic atheism cannot even explain the rise of empirical science. As William Lane Craig was arguing in his network, and other people have argued, empirical science only arose in the Western world because the great thinkers and scientists of the past believed that there was a creator, there was an intelligent designer, and therefore that meant there was an ordered universe with regular scientific natural laws which could be investigated. Because there is law in nature, there's a lawgiver. Because there's lawgiver, there's law. And that's the reason why science got off the ground. And all the great scientists of the past and the great thinkers of the past believed in God. Now, theophobic atheists are not only wrong in thinking that, belief in God is necessarily the enemy of scientific progress, they are even more tragically mistaken in their belief that religious faith is incompatible with liberty. At the philosophical level, liberty would have no functional purpose if it were not for the fact that we value human life and happiness and believe that freedom is essential for the release of personal creativity and the pursuit of knowledge, truth, and virtue. But if freedom is valued for these reasons, this implies it only has meaning, freedom only has meaning and significance within an objective and eternal moral order. And as we have just been discussing, as I have just been arguing, such a moral order points to the existence of God. Furthermore, it is also a historical fact that the growth of liberty and constitutional government owes a critical debt to the Judeo-Christian view of human life and destiny. It is because we are made in the image of God, because human beings are made in the image of God, and are therefore the children of a good and loving creator, that it is wrong to kill, injure, or oppress them. That is why liberal democracy developed in the Western world over a long period, and it's also why Christian sentiment played such an important role in the anti-slavery campaigns of the 19th century and the growth of humanitarian legislation during the same period. If you want to read a really inspiring story of Christians at work in the world of politics, read the story of Wilberforce and the campaign to abolish the slave trade. It's a very good book called about Wilberforce, biography of Wilberforce, called God's Politician, which by Garth Lean, it's not in my paper, I'm afraid, God's Politician by Garth Lean. It was published in paperback about 25 years ago, but you might be able to get hold of it secondhand on Amazon, via Amazon Books. God's Politician by Garth Lean, G-A-R-T-H, and then Lean, L-E-A-N. That's an inspiring story of the role of Christians in the abolition of the slave trade. And then there was a whole succession of generations of Christians in British politics who fought for humanitarian legislation in the factories and so on. And another reason why there is a link between Christianity and liberty is that the very idea of the rule of law originated in the biblical concept that the law of God is above the king. See, in the ancient world, in the oriental despotisms like Persia and so on, and that was also the attitude of the pagan Romans, the state was supreme. The word of the ruler was supreme. But the biblical view of politics and of law is that the law of God is above the state. The law of God is above the king. And if you study the history of political philosophy, you will find most of the great political philosophers of the Western tradition were Christians. Certainly most of them, nearly all of them, believed in God. Even fierce critics of the Catholic Church, like Voltaire, believed in God. He was a deist. He recognized the cosmological and the design arguments for the existence of God. And he was mainly opposed to the Catholic Church because of its persecution of Protestants and free thinkers, and its very bad record on the subject of human rights. Now, of course, you know, I referred earlier to the crimes committed in the name of religion by sections of the church over the centuries. But I would argue that the crimes committed in the name of religion, whether we're thinking of the Spanish Inquisition in the 16th century or whether we're thinking of Islamic fanatics and tyrants today, do not discredit belief in God. They merely reveal the hypocrisy of religious leaders. Actually, Richard Cunningham gave a rather good example. It's rather, you know, if somebody says he's a vegetarian and then jumps over his neighbor's fence and eats his neighbor's pet rabbit, does that discredit vegetarianism, or does it discredit, or does it expose the guy as a hypocrite? You know, so you can't simply argue that the biblical concept of God or belief in God necessarily leads to oppression and persecution. Also, the crimes committed in the name of religion, in the name of God, actually bear witness to the truth of the biblical doctrine of human nature, that human nature is fallen, that human beings are imperfect, that human nature has been corrupted by rebellion against God. And so the fact that, you know, you can point to Christians who've got feet of clay proves nothing. It just proves, yes, the Bible is correct. So the truth is that it is theophobic atheism, not religious faith, which is hostile to liberty. And I would say that atheism is hostile to liberty for two reasons. First of all, it undermines people's belief in the ultimate value of life, because we're just biological robots, and it undermines people's belief in the existence of an eternal moral law to which they are accountable, and it undermines their belief in a judge who will hold them to account. And this in turn encourages amoral attitudes and behavior, and it encourages also the belief in politics that the state is supreme and the ends justify the means. And what have the results of this been in the 20th century? The growth of crime and delinquency and breakup of families, the growth of alcoholism and suicide in increasingly secularized Western societies, and the advent of the bloodiest political tyrannies in history. Perhaps Lenin best encapsulated the theophobic spirit of totalitarian socialism when he wrote in 1920, "We do not believe in everlasting morality, and we denounce all this lying rubbish about it." I've got a whole file of quotes from Lenin. There's another quote which is a favorite of mine. "If, for the success of communism, we must exterminate 9/10 of the population, we must not recoil before such sacrifices." Example of where atheism can lead you. Now, interestingly enough, and in order to emphasize, well, actually, before giving you some quotes, it is sobering to reflect on the fact that the communist regimes, the communist dictatorships of the 20th century, have murdered over 100 million people since 1917. That is a well-established fact. And at the end of my paper, I give you some sources for those statistics. Over 100 million people killed in internal repression by communist dictatorships in China, in Russia, in Cuba, in North Vietnam, in North Korea, all over the place. That's a terrible, you know, we all know about the Nazi Holocaust, the killing of the Jews, but very few people are aware of the communist Holocaust, the murder of over 100 million people. That's more than the total number of casualties on all sides in both world wars. That's been a death toll of totalitarianism in the 20th century. And that totalitarianism has been directly related to theophobic atheism, to believe that there's no God, therefore everything is permitted, and there is no rule above the state. And there are all sorts of quotes I can give you to just reinforce this truth. First of all, let me quote you from Richard Wurmbrand. I don't know how many of you have read or heard about Richard Wurmbrand. He was a great Romanian Christian pastor and preacher who was imprisoned by the communists in Romania after the Second World War, when the Iron Curtain came down, and was tortured, and eventually, after a lot of international protest, after many years, released. And he wrote a lot of books, and this is what he says. "The cruelty of atheism is not hard to believe when man has no faith in the reward of good or the punishment of evil. There is no reason to be human. There is no restraint from the depths of evil which is in man. the communist torturers, and he's speaking now from personal experience, he's now speaking of what was said to him in prison. The communist torturers often said, "There is no God, no hereafter, no punishment for evil. We can do what we wish." I have heard one torturer even say, "I thank God, in whom I don't believe, that I have lived to this hour when I can express all the evil in my heart." Terrible, terrible quote. And there are lots of other quotes to give you. I mean, look, there's Hitler, for example. "I freed Germany from the stupid and degrading fallacies of conscience and morality. We will train young people before whom the world will tremble. I want young people capable of violence, imperious, relentless, and cruel." That was what Hitler said. And interestingly enough, one of the most interesting thinkers to read on this subject of God and morality and values and whether you have any values if you abolish God and don't believe in his existence, of course, the most important thinker to read on that subject is Nietzsche, who, incidentally, eventually went mad, died in a lunatic asylum. And he stopped believing in God. He stopped believing in God. But he was honest. He recognized what the consequences were of no longer believing in God. And so this is what he said about that. "When one gives up the Christian faith," this is what Nietzsche wrote, "one pulls the right to Christian morality out from under one's feet. This morality is by no means self-evident. Christianity is a system, the whole view of things, thought out together. By breaking one main concept out of it, the faith in God, one breaks the whole. It stands or falls with faith in God." An even more spectacular example of this, from Nietzsche, and incidentally making the point that there is an intimate link between Christianity and liberty, between Christianity and humanitarianism. Here are some more Nietzsche quotes. "Pity crosses the law of development, which is the law of selection," because he believed in Darwinism. Pity preserves what is ripe for destruction. It defends those who have been disinherited and condemned by life. "The weak and the failure shall perish, first principle of our love of man, and they shall even be given every possible assistance. What is more harmful than any vice? Active pity for all the failures and all the weak, Christianity." In other words, Nietzsche rejected Christianity because it preserved all the weak people who he thought ought to be eliminated in order to produce a sort of master race of supermen who could demonstrate their freedom in a kind of existential sense by simply doing whatever they like. In fact, Nietzsche's argument was that we only demonstrate our inner freedom by seeking power and doing whatever we like to other human beings. It shows our total freedom from morality. And so you see this rejection of God and an objective moral law leads straight to totalitarianism. And even more significantly and interestingly, in another quote of Nietzsche's, this is what he says again about Christian morality. "Christian morality granted man an absolute value as opposed to his smallness and accidental occurrence in the flux of being and passing away. Morality," he means Christian morality, "guarded the underprivileged by assigning to each an infinite value. Supposing that the faith in this morality would perish, then the underprivileged would no longer have this comfort, and they would perish. Nihilism is a symptom that the underprivileged have no comfort left." Then he says, this is interesting, "Christianity," wrote Nietzsche, "Christianity is the reverse of the principle of selection," that is, of natural selection. "In practice, this general love of mankind has weakened the power, responsibility, and lofty duty of sacrificing men. Society as the trustee of life is responsible for every botched life that comes into existence. It should in many cases actually prevent procreation. The weak and the botched," by which he means, of course, the handicapped, "shall perish, and they ought even to be helped to perish." Nietzsche, the consequences of atheism and moral relativism. And there are lots of other quotes I could give you. I'll just leave you two more, one from Lenin and one from an American 19th century intellectual called Oliver Wendell Holmes. But this is what Lenin wrote. "We say that morality is entirely subordinated to the interests of the class struggle of the proletariat. We say morality is what serves to destroy the old exploiting society and to unite all the toilers around the proletariat, which is creating a new communist society. We do not believe in an eternal morality." And Oliver Wendell Holmes, a 19th century American atheist who had a great influence on the development of American secular humanism, wrote, quote, "I see no reason for attributing to man a significance different in kind from that which belongs to a baboon or a grain of sand. I don't believe in an absolute principle or even a human ultimate, that man is always an end in himself, that his dignity must be respected." Well, so that shows you the link between Christianity and liberty on the one hand and between atheism and tyranny on the other. But the final charge against theophobic atheism is that it is theologically perverse, and it is theologically perverse because it misrepresents the nature of God and the necessary and right relationship between creator and creature. If reason, reinforced by revelation, tells us that God exists and is our creator, it follows logically that God is the eternal source of all life, love, goodness, beauty, truth, and joy. It means that he's not only the creator of the universe, but the author of our being and the source of our gifts, talents, and rationality. How then can it ever be right to reject or disobey him? How can we spurn the one who has created us and given us the gift of free will so that we can share his life, his love, and his joy? How can we ever be justified in rebelling against the divine wisdom, which alone enables us to think and argue in the first place? How can it be demeaning to worship the divine love and beauty, which is the true source of all that is precious and desirable in human existence? To refuse to acknowledge God's claims on us is to be like a plant refusing to grow towards the sunlight. It is to commit spiritual suicide. Can we be free without God? I leave the last word with one of the noblest figures in the history of liberty, the great 19th century Italian liberal, Joseph Mazzini, who devoted his whole life to fighting for the liberties of Italy and for the liberties of everyone in Italy. And this is what Mazzini wrote in his book, The Duties of Man, which is a magnificent book, by the way. The Duties of Man. This is what he wrote. "If there be not a supreme mind reigning over all human minds, who can save us from the tyranny of our fellow men whenever they find themselves stronger than we? If there be not a holy and inviolable law not created by men, what rule have we by which to judge whether an act is just or unjust? In the name of whom, in the name of what, shall we protest against oppression and inequality? Without God, there is no other sovereign than fact. Fact, before which the materialists ever bow themselves, whether its name be revolution or Napoleon Bonaparte," who was, of course, the great bogey figure, if you were living and looking back from this perspective of the middle of the 19th century. You could put Hitler or Lenin instead in that passage. So there is Mazzini, this great 19th century liberal, who spent his whole life fighting for the freedom of the different states and provinces of Italy to come together and form one country, and also fought for freedom at the personal level, fought for freedom of speech, freedom of worship, freedom for people to live their lives without being oppressed. This great Italian liberal was passionately believed in God and warned against the dangers of atheism. And again, if you look at the history of the United States, if you look at those who established the American Constitution, if you look at most of the great figures in the history of liberty, you will find that a disproportionate number of them were Christians and believed in God. So I think our case rests. So, you know, do ask questions or disagree or whatever. Soji, you go first.
Yeah. Christianity, particularly evangelicalism, is often portrayed as a bogeyman when it comes on the scene.
Yeah.
Human freedom, normally sexual freedom. What I think Christians, I feel like Christians in the media have to do is be able to come onto that sort of debate, but speak a language that doesn't quickly get them into trouble. Can't appeal to, you know, qualities like right and wrong. And I just wondered if you had any. I mean, I know you just spent, you know, an hour speaking to us about the dangers of liberty.
Yeah.
And succinctly for me, it's you know, that human beings are a harder taskmaster than God is. But have you got any smoother?
Well, yeah. I mean,
because I mean, obviously, this is a popular area now because. We're probably at a level of individualism in the UK that it's as high as it's ever been.
I'll tell you one argument which I think is very effective and which doesn't introduce God. I mean, but it's an argument against sort of relativism and a belief that you ought to be able to do whatever you like. And that is that, you see, what I was trying to argue and what I argue in the pamphlet I've given you on libertarianism is that if you take freedom too far, it commits suicide. It becomes self-destructive. Now, I don't know how many of you have read C.S. Lewis's book, The Abolition of Man. Right. So, in this book, which was originally an essay on literature, on some aspect of English literature, which was written during the Second World War, C.S. Lewis argued that it is only by having an objective moral law written on our hearts, a sense of right and wrong, that enables us to be free as individuals. Because unless we have a sense of right and wrong, as it were, to which we refer when we're trying to make choices, what will happen if we do away with morality, if we no longer believe that there is a right and wrong, is that we will simply do whatever immediately appeals to us. So we'll become simply the victims. We will lose our inner freedom because our behavior will simply become conditioned by our immediate physical desires or emotional responses. Yes, but the problem is it destroys freedom because, you know, if you... Well, it obviously destroys other people's freedom, but it also destroys the person who is behaving like this, because it means that for example, if every time you feel an impulse to commit adultery or to steal or to take drugs or something, what will eventually happen is that you will become less and less able to resist the impulse to do these things. So there may suddenly come a time when, you know, you've been playing around sexually, but you find somebody who you really love and you want to, you know, have a long-term relationship with her, but you're no longer capable of maintaining a long-term relationship because you've got so used to having, you know, being promiscuous on the sexual level that you become a sort of, you know, the sexual equivalent of an alcoholic. And, I mean, you'll know as a doctor, there is a genuine problem of sexual addiction for a lot of people. Similarly, you know, you might experiment with, obviously a more obvious example is you might experiment with drugs because you think it expands your consciousness or something, as so many people did in the 1960s, and then suddenly find you're hooked and you can't get off it. Or you know, you're so used to double-crossing people and telling lies that you find it very difficult to become an honest person once you decide that actually you would like to be honest and have some lasting relationships. So the result of, so this is what I would argue, the result of not believing that there is such, that there is an objective moral law, an objective right and wrong, and deciding to just behave any way you feel like, means you simply, but your actions, your choices, become sort of almost predetermined by your sort of basest appetites. You know, you just become a creature of appetite rather than somebody who can take a step back in order to think, in order to then choose. So that's, you know, and I think a lot of, particularly people who will have gone down the road of drugs or, you know, sexual promiscuity, or perhaps who've grown up in a broken home, you know, because their parents behaved like that, you know, this may resonate with them as an argument. They may say, yes, that leads to self-destruction. So, you know, so that might be a way of trying to get round this problem. I don't know. It's just a thought. Yeah, anyone? Yeah.
I suppose that if one could tell, social libertarianism,
yeah.
And but also the personal level, people's maximum, pursuit of individual happiness. Yeah. Obviously, there are limits, social limits, in the sense that, you know, some libertarians would argue that the limit is someone else, as long as they give permission, you can do whatever you like,
yeah,
with someone else, as long as they give permission, you can, yeah, do that with them, and that's our basic, you know, in a pluralist society, rule, really, or whatever. You know, it's a sort of, I'm thinking of an Engelbart and his sort of ideas on libertarianism. But if you, I mean, I think that a lot of people would say that I'll limit, you know, say drug taking or sexual promiscuity, because I can see in myself in the end that will not lead to happiness. I'm not accepting any absolute moral law other than happiness, but I can see that going down that road is, it's not going to lead me to happiness, so therefore I will choose not to take drugs. It's not a, you know, an absolute moral thing, but it's a sense in terms of leading a happy life. So, you know, what can, I think you can get around that sort of, you know, I mean, appealing to sort of common sense. It doesn't necessarily strengthen an argument for an absolute, I think.
Well,
Somebody's definition of postmodernism of nihilism with a smile. You can say, yeah, okay, we don't have real freedom, we don't have real morality, but who cares? You know, let's just.
Yeah, but the problem is. But the problem with the argument, though, is that if it's simply a question of happiness, you know, the problem is, what is happiness? You know, if I mean, it obviously, it contributed to the happiness of the Nazis to exterminate Jews and Gypsies and you know, and anyone who disagreed with them. It contributes to the happiness of paedophiles to abuse children. So you can, I mean, I think you can. I think one of the problems, I think psychologically, one of the problems that some people have is that they, you know, they have their definition of happiness, say. And they think everyone else has the same definition. So then the system works, you see. Okay, we'll pursue happiness. My happiness is to respect, you know, it, you know, is based on, I respect everyone's freedom to sort of live their lives and, you know, do their own thing. I will do my own thing. But then, you know, someone down the road, their happiness consists of actually preventing you doing your own thing and oppressing you, you know, and having a sort of oppressive system where they're on top of the pyramid, exploiting everyone else, you know. So you have to have common rules and common values, and then the question. I mean, I think perhaps a more effective answer is to say, well, you know, I'm not arguing that unless people all believe in God and particularly believe in the biblical view of God, they can't form a society or have any kind of legal system or live in any kind of harmony. You know, they'll all be at each other's throats, cutting each other's throats all day long. I'm not saying that. Obviously, self-interest plays an enormous role in ensuring that a certain minimum of social rules are observed. But that there's a difference between accepting that may be the case and arguments about what is true, because this kind of utilitarian, well, it's all a matter of self-interest argument breaks down when you're confronted by, you know, nihilists who say, well, you know, it may be in your self-interest to live in, you know, what you call a free society, but it is in my self-interest to get a whole gang together and take over your society and make you my slaves. And then you have no comeback to such a person other than by challenging them about what is right. You see, and on the utilitarian level, it is, you know, if you look at the history of the 20th century, it can be demonstrated empirically that the gradual erosion of belief in God and belief in an absolute moral standard has actually led to great social deterioration, as well as to totalitarianism. So even though, you know, it's obviously not true to argue that, you know, as soon as people stop believing in God, everything collapses and there's total permanent civil war, you know, and there's no kind of organized society or legal system or any moments of peace and social harmony. Although, you know, that may obviously not be true. Nevertheless, the very fact there's been this tremendous deterioration socially and culturally and politically in the 20th century, when there's been this great erosion of belief in God, does underline the truth that even at the practical level, utilitarian level, even in terms of self-interest, it is in the self-interest of atheists to live in a Christian society, to live in a society where people, where at least even if they don't believe in God, other people believe in God. But even if they don't believe in an objective moral law, other people believe in an objective moral law. William Lane Craig, I don't know whether it was William Lane Craig or, no, it was one of the guy who spoke our first evening on Saturday, you know, saying that someone else that I was in a workshop with argued that he had a relativist student. And so what he did was she produced a very good philosophy exam paper, and he wrote on her exam paper, "Excellent, mark fail." So she came to him, this philosophy student, and said, "Hang on, you know, you say that my exam paper is excellent, so why have you given me a fail?" Well, her philosophy teacher said, "Well, I'm postmodern. It is good, but I don't see why, just because it's good, that you should therefore have a pass mark. There are no absolute standards. I decided you should fail. To me, it just feels good to fail you, although I recognize your paper's a very good one." You know, and then she realized, of course, he was calling her bluff. So, you know, always try and call people's bluff. Did you want to say, well, I mean, you come from Slovakia, Eastern Europe. I mean, what do you think about this whole subject? I've got to interrupt you. Look, we've only got 5 minutes to go, and as Carol will tell you, you're going to have to fill in these assessment forms, begging the organisers never to allow me to give another workshop. That's all right, Pete. Yeah, I finished, yeah. Yeah.